past one.
Good afternoon and welcome to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. This hour, we're trying something we haven't done lately on this show. We're asking for your calls. We're talking about metro news, environment news, education news, police news, and business news. These topics go by fast, so if you want to comment, call quickly, 502-814-8255, or send an email to news@wfpl.org. You can also send us a tweet at WFPL News or find us on Facebook. With me now in the studio from the WFPL newsroom, our political editor Philip Bailey, environment reporter Erica Peterson, and our new reporter Devin Katayama. Thanks for being here, guys.
Hey.
Thanks.
All right, so Philip, I want to start with you. The most recent news, the mayor signed an executive order extending benefits to the domestic partners of Metro employees.
Yes, this was a campaign issue for a while when then-candidate Fisher was running against Councilman Hal Heiner. This issue had come up really as an extension, I think, of the gay rights movement in Louisville that had, gotten a lot of support over the years. It had been a struggle to pass the Fairness Ordinance in 1999, which barred discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. For many gay rights advocates, the extension of domestic partner benefits was that movement, I guess, going into 2.0, essentially. Today, the mayor signed an executive order extending those domestic partner benefits. It will go into effect July 1, 2012, giving the city some time to study the program and how it will work. City officials estimate it will cost the taxpayers about $400,000, which the mayor points out is less than 1% of the overall budget. And it will probably be applied to about 300 to 400 employees at this point.
And did the mayor talk about how why now he's doing this, why for the next fiscal year it's happening?
The mayor didn't really outline the reason for why now, but he did give, I think, an explanation about why he felt it was important in his mind. He said that, you know, despite people who were criticizing him for not having public input, he felt that this was the fair thing to do, that if Louisville was going to truly be competitive, it needs to extend these benefits to all families and to be equal. And one of the people he invited up on the podium, the lectern, excuse me, to speak with him and make some comments was Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh, who voted for the Fairness Ordinance back in 1999, who was on the then Board of Aldermen, who came to the press conference today with her partner, Laura, and said essentially that this was an extension of the gay rights movement here in Louisville.
20 years ago, it was courageous for folks like Carla Wallace and Lisa Gunterman and other people in this room, Eric Graninger, Tom Owen, to step out and take a stand for fairness. Today, it's not that way. Today, it's common sense. It is the right thing to do. It is good for business. It is the fact that these folks did change the climate. They educated people, and the overwhelming majority of people in this community, our country, and our country support GLBTQ initiatives and people and valuing people as people. And so I thank those people for your courage over the last 20 years and for starting this ball rolling, and for the mayor, for Mayor Fisher, for bringing us here today. You know, I knew it was going to be, I knew it was a new day, the night of the mayor's inaugural ball, when I had the opportunity to go up and interrupt them and ask for a dance myself, except it was with Alex. The First Lady of Metro Louisville. And not the mayor. I knew it was a new day.
And Philip, this just happened, but what's been the reaction so far from the Fairness Campaign and from other city lawmakers?
Well, the Fairness Campaign has praised the issue. They praised the decision, really, saying that this is, you know, a campaign promise that Mayor Fisher had made, that this is very promising, that once again, Louisville is leading the way for gay rights here in the state of Kentucky. Other city lawmakers were in attendance and joined the mayor when he signed the executive order. However, the Family Foundation has come out and said that they opposed the decision not only for moral reasons, but felt that the mayor should have had public hearings, similar to the public input you had in the 1990s leading up to the passage of the Fairness Ordinance. Those were often very contentious debates held at City Hall and other parts of this community. Mayor Fisher said that he didn't feel this was something that needed to be debated or have a public hearing about, that this was fair, this was right, and he needed to move forward.
Right, and there, we often see these two schools of thought when issues like this come up, rights issues for groups of people. And one side will say, leave it to voters. Another side will say, no, this is something that someone has to take leadership on.
Yeah, and I think you still see both opponents and supporters of gay rights in any form, whether it's the issue of marriage or the issue of domestic partner benefits. There's two different schools of thought on that. And I think that for many who remember the fairness battles back in the 1990s, the thought process was at that time that it was a grassroots movement, but you really didn't see leadership at the city level. Many gay rights advocates today will admit that former Mayor Jerry Abramson didn't really spend that much political capital on fairness during the 1990s. And while Mayor Armstrong, who was a mayor from, I believe, 1998 to 2000 until merger, there was some support on his behalf, but they feel that this is the first time you had the leader of the city, the mayor, saying clearly to everyone, this is where I stand on the issue. There's no need to have a debate, and let's move forward.
And any idea on what's next? Any indication of any progress beyond this?
The question I think really that I had for Mayor Fisher and for Fairness Campaign Director Chris Hartman was Mayor Fisher stressed in his speech that this was going to attract people to the city. That in order for Louisville to be a 21st century city, it needs to be open to different peoples, to mm-hmm. all families, and be diverse. The question, however, is that for a young LGBT American, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered citizen, if they hear this news and they're attracted to coming to Louisville, will they be deterred by the fact that the state recently, in 2004, voters passed a marriage amendment to the Constitution barring same-sex marriage? That while the city is sending one message with the Fairness Ordinance and now domestic partner benefits, is the state sending another message altogether? Chris Hartman, the director of the Fairness Campaign, said it gets better, that he's encouraged that Kentucky will take a lead role on overturning that amendment, but that's something that Mayor Fisher really didn't want to address directly. He said that this is about domestic partner benefits today, and that's a separate issue altogether.
All right, and Erica, turning to you, there's two studies came out this week commissioned by LG&E, Louisville Gas and Electric, the power utility here in Louisville, about coal ash.
Yes, there were. Well, first of all, pretty much coal ash is what you get when you burn coal. Mm-hmm. There's no way around it. If you have a coal-burning power plant, there's going to be coal ash left over. And the issue here is that LG&E stores this coal ash on their site in southwest Louisville on Cane Run Road in two ways. There's a huge pond with coal ash in it, and there's also a landfill. And the study that LG&E released this week basically gave a little bit of weight to some concerns in the neighborhood. People have been complaining there for a while that that the ash is leaving the landfill and contaminating their homes. They say, look at the siding of my house. You can actually see coal ash on it, or what appears to be coal ash in some places. And they're worried about the health hazards of that. So the LG&E study said they took samples from three of the homes, and they did find traces of fly ash. Some of the samples were composed of more than 50% of them was fly ash. So some pretty significant amounts of fly ash in those.
And so what had LG&E previously said? Were they of the belief that there was ash on these homes?
Well, LG&E had said, we aren't sure what's on there. We aren't sure where it's coming from. And it's important to note that that they still aren't sure, because they released a second study that took samples in a different way, that took samples passively rather than going up to a house and actually wiping it and saying, we're going to take the sample. Basically, the other samples in the second report relied on air sampling, where they set up a monitor and it just gathers, the air that's going through it. And those samples found a lot less fly ash in them. So LG&E is still saying they really don't know what's going on. They aren't sure whether, one test or the other. They say the first test seems like an anomaly compared to what they've seen before, but further testing is needed pretty much.
But what are the ramifications here if there is coal ash on these houses?
Well, here's the issue. LG&E is permitted to release a certain amount of coal ash out their smokestack. It's in their Title V permit with the city. And they are permitted to release a much smaller amount from their landfills, just stuff that, you know, might blow off the top, no great quantities. The issue is if the city decides that dust or ash is leaving the landfill and leaving LG&E's property and is creating a nuisance for residents, it can fall under the city's fugitive dust emissions law, which basically supersedes LG&E's permit, and the city could ask them to fix the problem, or tell them to fix the problem, rather.
And so what's next with this?
Well, LG&E is actually meeting with the three families whose homes were tested on Monday. To explain the reports, show them around the plant, show them what they're doing to address their concerns. And the city will be, the Air Pollution Control District will be meeting internally to decide what to do about the two reports, which to give more weight to, which is an issue spokesman Matt Stoll talked to me about, saying that with the second report that showed a lot less coal ash in it, there were some concerns about perhaps the weather had affected those. I guess if you take sampling, I'm not an expert in dust sampling, but if you take sampling during a really rainy time, it might collect less.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to kind of weigh those and decide whether there's enough to tell the plant to take remedial action.
And these studies, there's this meeting on Monday that's happening, but these studies are just recently released. How were you able to find these? What's been the reaction so far that these studies are out there?
I guess it was just luck this time, Gabe. I've been working on some longer stories about coal ash, so I filed a lot of open records requests. And Chris Whalen from LG&E called me on Tuesday to let me know that they had just gotten the results of this back. And it was this report was included in one of my original FOIA requests to the city, so I got a copy of it then. The reaction from the citizens who live by Cane Run to at least the first report was kind of relief. I mean, they've been feeling like they have what they think is a very serious problem. And until now, LG&E hasn't offered a lot of scientific proof that this is happening. So I think they're hopeful that at least this first report gives them their argument some weight and will maybe cause the company to do something about it.
All right. And we'll have a lot more on coal ash coming up in the next week, a series of stories.
Yes.
All right. So, make sure to listen in for that. Also, more on this story is on our website, WFPL.org. Philip, turning back to you, and also we have a call from Louisville on the previous topic, on the expanded benefits. Doug, hello.
Hi, this is Doug. I just want to say, you know, this extended benefits is not a gay right, it's a family right, and it makes our community more attractive, not just to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, but to heterosexual people who want to live in a community free from the influence of religion that might not be their choice. And so I think it's a great economic benefit for us. And in reporting stories like that, it's not just a gay issue. It's a family issue and a community issue. Even though I'm, you know, happy that gay people can have that benefit, it's really more a bigger benefit and a costlier benefit for heterosexual couples.
All right, Doug, thanks for your comment. And we should mention this will affect heterosexual people as well, right, Philip?
Sure. I mean, at this point, as in all policies where domestic partner benefits have been extended, they're not exclusive to gay couples. They are expansive for all couples who happen to be cohabiting and who may not be legally married or under maybe a religious ceremony or under what we can consider to be the legal definition of marriage in the state of Kentucky. So it's certainly not just for LGBT citizens. However, I think it's important to note that this was something that gay rights advocates were continuously pushing because of the marriage amendment, because they are barred from the institution of marriage by law in the state of Kentucky. This is seen as a way to retain those talented individuals and attract them to local cities and businesses.
All right. And in other city news, the charging committee met to talk about Councilwoman Judy Green's removal trial. And Philip, you covered that.
Yeah, the charging committee is made up of the five council members who moved to impeach Councilwoman Judy Green, a bipartisan group of council members. They met a few weeks ago just to really hire legal staff. They hired attorney Greg Hovius, who will act as the prosecutor in the trial-like proceedings for her removal trial. This meeting was really just to question Jefferson County Attorney Mike O'Connell, asking Mr. O'Connell questions about how the trial would be run, what the rules and parameters are, how they would deliberate, who can talk to whom, and about what, and how the proceedings will really go. This is, like I said, unprecedented for metro government. Councilman Green is the first council member to be impeached. She's the first elected official in metro government to receive a letter of reprimand and censure from the Ethics Commission in connection to the two separate ethics charges that she faced over these past 6 months, both of which came back that she deliberately violated the city's ethics ordinance. She has appealed both of those decisions in court, and her attorney in the removal trial, defense attorney Derwin Webb, he argues that because the councilwoman has appealed the Ethics Commission decisions, that the council should postpone having the removal trial, which is scheduled for sometime, it's believed that it will be sometime in early August. Mr. Webb told me that he feels that the council may be moving too quickly, and that if the courts happen to overturn the Ethics Commission's ruling, that should change the council's focus and maybe even throw out the removal charges altogether. He also filed a response to the misconduct charges that were filed at the Metro Council yesterday, challenging the presumptions and the accusations in those. And he says that Councilwoman Green has no intention to resign. There had been more speculation that she was thinking about it, but he says that she's a fighter, that she's committed to doing this, that she will not be talking about her ongoing ethics scandal on her weekly radio show, but that, you know, she plans on fighting this to the end, really.
Any indication that the council may hold off on this trial for the appeals?
I asked Mike O'Connell, that the Jefferson County attorney who will be representing the jury, the remaining members of the council, the 20 remaining members, their legal counsel essentially will be the Jefferson County attorney. And he says that he doesn't see any reason for the trial to be postponed at this point. He says sometime in August. Greg Hovius, the attorney for the five members who have impeached Councilman Green, he wants this trial to go as early as the second week of August, and it lasts between somewhere to 2 or 3 days. So it seems that August is still the timeline, and Mr. Webb may have to file or make a recommendation to move the trial back. But at this point, it seems that August is still where we're set to go.
And Councilwoman Green will be on the council for this this whole time, but her powers will be somewhat limited, right?
Well, no, at this point, I mean, she still has all the rights and privileges of an elected member of the Metro Council. She's been impeached. She has not been removed. Mm-hmm. She has the authority to vote on measures to appropriate funds as any other member of the Metro Council is. This is a totally separate matter. Although she has been found guilty by the Ethics Commission, this is a separate matter altogether. So while the trial is going on, she is still an elected member of this council. There is a question, however, of the limbo situation as we get further and further into this process. However, I think it's important for folks to know that on Monday, the 20 remaining members of the council who will act as the jury, they will be officially sworn in. Mm-hmm. They will set hearing or meeting times and also assign officers for the Metro Council Court. Officially, they will be known as the Metro Council Court.
And so if they do vote to remove, there's an appeal process on that as well.
Yes. An elected member of the Metro Council, if removed, has the right to appeal to Circuit Court. The question, as I was mentioning the limbo period earlier, mm-hmm. is that in the law, it really isn't clear if a Metro Council member is voted off of the council and the seat hasn't been vacated yet, what powers does that council member retain? It's pretty clear from the state law that member can't vote, but they're not removed from the council officially. They have 30 days to appeal. After that 30 days, I believe the clerk has the right to declare that seat vacated. So it would appear that if that were to happen to any council member, like I said, this is so unprecedented that many professors and legal experts and those within metro government sort of scratching their heads and going through more documents to find out the answers to some of these questions. But I think that because it's such uncharted territory for many of us in the media in particular, these questions are new and we're having all this really for the first time.
And it's have you heard anything from people in Councilman Green's district on what's happening there? Is she moving money around still, you know, funding programs, doing things that council members typically do for their district?
There's been very little activity out of District 1. There was, for example, a appropriation that was held really since December for a neighborhood association in Councilman Green's district. I believe that she tried to appropriate $2,000 for a group called Westover it's a neighborhood association in District 1, that had been held up really since December. I believe that the council rules stipulate that if after 6 months, if the appropriation does not move at all, it has to be refiled. So there's very little activity whatsoever coming out of District 1 officially. However, she does have and maintains a level of support from people in the community, particularly Reverend Charles Elliott, civil rights activist Maddie Jones, and others, who said that, you know, the councilwoman has basically been railroaded, saying that she has been mistreated through all this and that other council members have made similar decisions and haven't been prosecuted to this degree.
All right. And we'll be following that next week as well, as the council members are sworn in and as this keeps going. And now we turn to a new presence here at WFPL, Devin, our new reporter. And one of the first reports you've done is it's an update on the governor's race and education. Tell us about that.
David Williams, Senate President David Williams, was at the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce this week, and he asked, he mentioned that the Jefferson County School Board should be dissolved, meaning that the Jefferson County School Board should be changed to make basically the mayor appoint the superintendent, and then the Metro Council would act as the school board. And he made some comments at the Chamber of Commerce. I didn't get the audio for that, but I did speak with him afterwards, and this is what he said.
Having observed them raise taxes year after year, give raises that no other governmental officials are giving, and make decisions as far as the student assignment plan, I've come to the conclusion that the Jefferson County Board of Education, as it's set up now, is not the correct governance system for schools in Jefferson County.
Now, he did say that the school board was too small and that the Metro Council would be a much more diverse group of people. And I spoke with Steve Imhoff, the Jefferson County School Board chair, and he had this to say.
He's running for governor. That's why he made those comments, and he thinks he can pick up some extra votes in Jefferson County by making those comments. That's the only reason that a guy that lives 100 or 200 miles away would make any kind of comments like that at all. I have no interest in what they do in his county. If I happen to move there and run for city council or school board, then I might have something to say about what they do there. I have no interest in interfering with what they do in his county. And by the same token, I don't think he needs to have any interest in what we do here in Jefferson County.
And that also seemed to be what the mayor said as well. They mentioned how he shouldn't be making these comments and why he's making these comments at this point. They seem to point towards his run for governor.
And I'll jump in here and say, if you have a comment about this, certainly there's been a lot of talk in the community about the schools recently, some controversy around the appointment of the new superintendent. 502-814-8255 is the number to make your comment on the air. You can also send an email to news@wfpl.org, Facebook and Twitter, WFPL News as well. And something to mention with this is that JCPS has, in a lot of ways, is larger than Metro government. It's a larger budget. Philip, feel free to jump in here. It's, more employees, right? More, and the budget is larger.
Yeah, the budget for Jefferson County Public Schools is close to $1 billion. I believe it actually is slightly over $1 billion. So it's rather interesting. What's interesting about, however, I think Senator Williams' comments is not only that it's, you know, out of nowhere, him making this sort of bold statement, but it's very similar. Some of the language he's used, very similar to what the Courier-Journal editorial board has said about the JCPS school board for the past 10 months, using words like dysfunctional. I believe that the Courier has said and called the board dysfunctional for a number of months now about a series of issues, whether it was former Superintendent Sheldon Berman's contract negotiations, whether it was the new candidates to replace him, issues with busing and decisions to have some of these meetings, personnel meetings, in secret behind closed doors. So JCPS, I think Senator Williams is making a calculated political statement here, saying that we should get rid of the school board because JCPS school board has been a very divisive issue for a number of years, not just because of busing, but because of some of the decisions that the school board has made directly. Now, the question that's really interesting is that Williams is essentially saying, let's take JCPS, which many people have been critical of, and let's put it in Metro government. And even those who have been critical of the board, the school board, such as Attorney Teddy Gordon, say that while he's critical of the school board and doesn't agree with its decision making oftentimes, switching it over to Metro government isn't the answer. So in many ways, I think observers have pointed out that this could just be a political stunt. Imhoff's statements seem sort of interesting only because Williams is running for governor, and he would have a prerogative to mention these sort of issues.
And certainly not the first time Williams has discussed the Jefferson County school situation before he's proposed legislation to put an end to the student assignment plan, effectively. This local schools bill, something that had been discussed as well. And moving on quickly to another education issue, the University of Louisville Board of Trustees met to evaluate President James Ramsey. Devin, you were there?
Right. They actually did a couple things. First, they evaluated James Ramsey, and nobody had anything bad to say about him, which has been the consensus in the past as well. During the evaluation, they also recommended a raise for Ramsey. And the way Ramsey gets paid, he gets paid through the University of Louisville, but he also gets paid through the University of Louisville Foundation, which is separate. So the University of Louisville agreed to a 5% raise, which he took, and they recommended to the foundation a 5% raise as well, that he be provided a 5% raise. They also recommended to the foundation that he be given a 25% bonus from his salary of, $456,000, which would be about a $114,000 bonus. And the reason that a lot of people on the board felt comfortable giving such a large bonus is because the last 3 years, Ramsey has declined a raise and a bonus because staff at University of Louisville were unable to get raises themselves.
And will he accept it this year, do you know?
It sounded like if he were to accept the bonus, and he didn't really want to say beforehand, but it sounded like if he were to accept the bonus, that he would give it back to the school in some capacity.
Hmm. And also, speaking of the UofL campus, on Monday, a water main burst at Floyd and Warnock Streets. This is something that we'd given a lot of updates that people have been following throughout the week. The boil advisory was placed on a lot of central Louisville after that. Everyone was boiling their water. It's been lifted entirely now. It was lifted in shifts for a while as of yesterday evening. The water's safe to drink. We're all drinking it right now. Philip has a giant glass of water.
We all have a glass of water.
Exactly. It's perfectly safe. The crews, we're told it's perfectly safe. The crews with the water company are out right now. They're trying to determine why this 80-year-old pipe burst. Some lanes of Eastern Parkway may be closed during this repair process. It's going to be a lengthy and costly process. The water company officials again say that there's no threat at the moment that rates will go up. They have a contingency fund for disasters and all of that. And as this was all happening, after this pipe burst, we heard from Mayor Greg Fisher online. He was speaking to people on Monday evening and throughout the week on Twitter. And Philip, there were some issues there.
Yeah, the thing about social networking, and the mayor's office admits to this, is that it's a catch-22. Recently, like you said, Gabe, during the crisis with the water main break, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher once again tweeted information that was more optimistic than accurate. That could be described. He sort of downplayed a little bit of what was going on. Fisher's spokesperson, Chris Pointer, says that, you know, the information comes out in real time. So when the mayor gets something, he tweets it. You know, it's right out there. Specifically, the mayor sent out alerts during the crisis through his official Twitter account that were reposted by several media outlets that told residents the situation would be cleared up the next day. The situation wasn't cleared up the next day. There were many businesses that had water issues, and the boil advisory was still in effect. So, and for those of us who remember when the tornadoes touched down in Louisville, the mayor made a similar comment about how there was, quote, relatively minor damage. And this was just when the first line of storms had hit, and then there was another line of storms. I don't think it's, for many people, residents who follow the mayor on his social networking, they enjoy it. They mm-hmm. enjoy the fact that they're connected to the mayor in that way, whether through his Facebook page or Twitter account. It's something that his predecessor did not do. It's a way for people to interact with the mayor more. And he updates it himself. He's said that many times. And I think at the end of the day, people, they understand, some supporters of his understand that these are mistakes that are getting made while he's getting information updated in real time. Others, however, point out that when you follow the mayor on social networking and he says something, you take that as gospel truth. And it can be I won't say dangerous, but it can be, people are wary of hearing information from a public official and then having it change a minute later or 2 seconds later or the next day, because they often go with that information and say, well, the mayor said it, I believe it.
And speaking of saying things, not believing things, and perhaps saying something kind of odd, Erica, you previously reported on a study that linked mountaintop removal coal mining to birth defects. Could you just remind us of that study?
Yeah, it was a study that was authored by scientists at West Virginia University and Washington State University, and basically found a correlation between mothers who lived in counties where there was mountaintop removal coal mining and babies born with birth defects.
And there was a response to that this week.
There was. A law firm posted a response on their website, basically pointing out some holes in the study. But unfortunately for them, most of their posting did not get any attention, because they also basically called out the authors for not accounting for possible inbreeding in their report. They used the term consanguinity, which... yeah, and that was not reacted to very well by pretty much anyone who heard it.
I can imagine. What's their response when they were approached with when they were asked about this in general?
Well, they took the post off their website entirely, and they did issue a statement saying that they didn't mean to imply anything. This is something that is taken into account in a lot of studies, which, from what I could tell, that is not exactly correct. But they took it off their website because they, you know, it hadn't been properly vetted, they said, before it went on there.
Okay. let's move on to a larger issue. We just heard the president speak a couple hours ago about the negotiations to raise the debt ceiling. And Philip, our senator, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Senate Minority Leader, has had a role in these discussions.
A prominent role, in fact. Senator McConnell introduced a plan this week, which has been dubbed the McConnell Plan, as sort of a fourth last-ditch offer on compromise between the two parties in these ongoing debt ceiling negotiations. Essentially, what McConnell's plan would do is it gives the president the authority to raise the debt ceiling on his own, I believe $12.5 trillion in three different installments, as long as those raises are coupled with spending cuts of the same or exceeding magnitude. There have been many within Senator McConnell's own party. Other Republican leaders have lashed out at the proposal, particularly members of Congress in the House. There have been many who said that McConnell plan would be dead on arrival if it were to be delivered to the House of Representatives in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. But it's interesting that President Obama and the White House have praised Senator McConnell for introducing the idea, saying that, you know, they still want to go through these long-term negotiations to come up with a long-term deal as both parties negotiate how to raise the debt, or if they will do it at all before the August 2nd deadline. But Senator McConnell has, I think, remained on the offensive. Just yesterday, he was on the Senate floor making a speech proposing that the Senate or the Congress should pass a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which would require Congress to balance the budget each year instead of having exceeding amounts of debt. The White House has said that's a non-starter. They're not really interested in that viewpoint. And many critics and observers have said that that's really McConnell's sort of offer to Tea Party members of his own party to appease them who are upset with him about his own original plan. Congressman Yarmouth, I think, has chimed in as well, saying that, you know, he's criticized the plan and really saying that Republicans as a whole have held the government hostage and held the president hostage over this issue. But it appears that if you look at this national issue from a local level, it seems like there's a lot of he said, she said going on in these debt negotiations. Mm-hmm. House leader, who's second in command to House Speaker John Boehner, Eric Cantor, made some comments after a meeting with President Obama, alleging that the president was agitated and stormed out of a meeting. Democratic members of the House and Senate alleging that Cantor was being rude. So it's really interesting that some of this federal stuff has really boiled down to high school politics.
Yeah, it really gets down to an almost petty level at times. Certainly something that we see quite often in politics, but it's interesting to see it tied to this debate as well.
Particularly given the gravity of the situation regarding our debt and how people have warned that this could, some say, represent economic Armageddon for the country.
And this is something that's it's moving at whatever pace, and it's something that we'll be following as well. And this is going to take us to our first break. I want to thank Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. And when we come back, Jesse Halliday from the Courier-Journal will join us to discuss a series of articles she wrote about Police Chief Robert White. And we'd like you to join us as well. What do you think of Chief White's leadership of the force? 502-814-8255, news at WFPL.org or WFPL News on Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. Joining us by phone is Jesse Halliday with the Louisville Courier-Journal. Hello, Jesse.
Hey, Gabe. How are you?
I'm good. So you wrote this series of articles, a few of them, about Police Chief Robert White's reputation and his history in Louisville. One of them dealt with his reputation with the Police Merit Board. First of all, what is the Merit Board, and how do they decide to hear cases? How do they interact with the chief?
It's a board of five citizens that are appointed by the mayor and two police officers who are elected by the officers at large. They serve as kind of like the civil service board would have done in the old county days, and it's the automatic appeal process that's set up through state law and allows officers who have been disciplined with suspensions to take that to another authority so that they can have a review to see if what the chief did was appropriate or not. So if you are an officer and you're given a suspension of five or more days, then you would go before the board for your appeal.
And Chief White has done pretty well when officers have come before the board.
Yeah, actually, a relatively small number of cases even get to the board. I mean, we were talking about 230-some suspensions over Chief White's first 8 years, and probably only 60 of them got appealed, and then only about maybe half of those made it to the board level, and some didn't get to hearings. But ultimately, only 9 times has the chief been overruled as far as when the board thought that he had not acted appropriately. So they either reduced the suspension or overturned a termination and gave an officer a suspension instead of a termination.
And is there one big reason, or is there a series of reasons why the chief tends to do so well, why the board is going along with the chief?
I'm not sure it's consistent. I think they do seem to, over the years that I've been going to the merit board, they seem to listen to the evidence put before them. Sometimes there may be some sense that, an officer just was judged a little too harshly, or they maybe bought an argument that, that wasn't the intent of the officer. And so it's not consistent from a board perspective as to why he does well. I think they just have to prove at the board level that what the chief did was reasonable and not excessive. They cannot increase what the chief did. They can only decrease it or uphold it.
And what can we glean from this as far as just how the chief may be seen by the rest of the force, or how he operates? What do we learn about the chief himself through this?
Well, I mean, I think the reason I sort of undertook this effort of going through every disciplinary letter that he's issued, which is roughly 1,200 or so, was because there isn't one consistent perception of what the chief's record is. Some people think he's too harsh. Some people think he's too lenient. He had made statements in the wake of a couple of high-profile firings and disciplinary actions that, he holds officers accountable. So it was just a matter of seeing what his record is. And I think when you read the piece, there is still wide, variation on whether people think he's fair or not. It's sort of perception is reality kind of a situation. There are a lot of officers who don't like what he's done, and it's often case by case.
And you also wrote about those officers that he has reprimanded and that he has fired, 28 officers, correct?
Right, 28. And that includes the two that were fired this year. The database that we collected was just through the end of 2010, but there have been two others. And I believe it's 3 cases. Those were overturned on appeal, and the officers were allowed to resign. We looked at the straight initial action. What was the first thing the chief did? Some of those people have gotten their jobs back through the appeal process, but 28 in all. And most of them are what you would call egregious incidents. you know, some kind of criminal act or and something that might have been found to be guilty in a court process. Some would have been maybe acquitted in a court process, but they were what the chief would call egregious acts, not very many pattern of behavior terminations.
And another article you wrote, it was an update to the 2009 series of stories about officers missing court. Could you tell us about this update?
Well, basically, what happened when my colleagues, Jason Riley and Ralph Dunlap, looked at the court records of officers, you know, they determined that a lot of officers were missing court for a variety of reasons. That launched probably what this department has seen as the largest disciplinary action in its history. You know, more than 400 officers were disciplined, mostly with written reprimands for not showing up when they were supposed to be in court. The chief had decided after those stories previously that he needed to find out what was really happening as far as officers not being there, try to determine what was wrong with the system. They've put in some safeguards. And I think what you're seeing is fewer officers missing court and a continued pattern of reprimanding, or then if you have already missed once, then you'll get a one-day suspension. If you miss again, you'll get a four-day suspension, and progressing that discipline on.
And is there any more progress to be made in fixing some of these issues uncovered in that first set of articles?
I mean, I think that, you know, there is ongoing work at the department level and in the court system level as far as trying to make sure that e-subpoena processes are working. They're monitoring it a lot more closely. I don't think anyone has said that it is a perfect system still and that it functions properly 100% of the time. I do think they continue to monitor it and look for areas where they may be having trouble if it's a court issue as far as notifying an officer. I mean, the e-subpoena process has really helped that, because previously there were many times when an officer wouldn't know he was supposed to be in court until after a court date, if at all. So that seems to have evened itself out and is now working more effectively.
All right, Jesse Halliday, thank you very much for joining us. Jesse Halliday with the Louisville Courier-Journal.
Thank you, Gabe.
All right, and when we come back, Ed Green and Steve Ivey from Business First will be here to discuss the latest business news. And we'd like you to join us as well. What do you think of the prospect of a super region between Louisville and Lexington? It's something we'll be discussing in the next segment. 502-814-8255, email news at WFPL.org, Facebook and Twitter, WFPL News. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. And welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. With me now are Ed Green and Steve Ivey from Business First. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Gabe.
Thanks a lot.
All right. And Ed, I want to start with you. You wrote about the Louisville-Lexington economic study about building up a super region, connecting the two cities. And this is going to be led by a familiar person.
That's right. Of course, I guess when we want to get something done here in Louisville now, we know who the go-to guy is, and it's Jim Host, who obviously led the construction of the Louisville Arena Authority and getting the KFC Yum Center online. But Mayor Fisher and Mayor Gray from Lexington are going to rely on him to kind of get that initiative started.
And so what sort of things will he be doing, and what's the finished product?
Well, they haven't said specifically, as they often do early on in an initiative, how this is going to work. But basically what they're saying is what they want to do is have the state's two largest cities work together to create, I guess, sort of this region that's known for advanced manufacturing initiatives, realizing that, you know, in the whole sentiment that the world is flat and that there are a lot of opportunities internationally, that if we can kind of leverage what we have here with the logistics, with the manufacturers that we have and the automakers and General Electric being here in Lexington, they have Lexmark, which is another really high-tech company, that they can kind of leverage what we have here to create this super region is what they're calling it.
And the city did recently receive a grant to work on this from Bloomberg Philanthropies.
That's right. They received the grant yesterday. I believe it's $4.8 million. Mm-hmm. They're going to receive from the philanthropic arm of Bloomberg and Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, for these mayor initiatives. And they're going to set aside some of that money for this initiative.
And where else is money for this going to come from?
they're going to use it internally. They're going to obviously look for matching. There's a matching element to the Bloomberg grant. Mm-hmm. They're going to fund that, some of that, from Louisville Metro funds to get that matching portion. They're also going to try to get some money from the business community.
And is there a deadline tied to this?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. And it's something we'll make sure to keep an eye on. And Steve, I'll turn to you. You wrote a part of this investigation looking at payments from pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, in many ways, the world of medicine and healthcare are becoming a lot more transparent. Some of that is due to some things happening with federal healthcare reform. And starting in a couple of years, pharmaceutical companies and device makers are going to have to disclose the payments that they make to healthcare providers. And so many of the major companies are getting out ahead of that deadline now. And we went through the databases that these companies publish just to find out really how much is coming to area providers here in Louisville. And what we found is that about 1,500 doctors and nurses here in the area had received a total of about $2 million last year.
And what does this money do? What's it used for? How's it work?
Sure. In most cases, it's used to pay providers for the consulting and advising that they do. They'll reimburse them for travel if they go to, deliver lectures to large groups of other physicians. And it's to advocate for the uses of the drugs that the companies make and consult with them on best practices.
And so and now these payments have to be disclosed. There's some controversy over that.
That's right. Some advocates see this as a good thing, that this has been a longstanding practice, that nobody has really had a good grasp on exactly how widespread and deep it runs. And they're also concerned that patients, now that they know, they can have an honest discussion with their doctors about whether, receiving six figures from a pharmaceutical company might give you some incentive to prescribe a drug.
Yeah, there is some people will argue that this might influence doctors to prescribe. Have there been studies of that? And what do doctors say about that?
There have been a little bit of research. I know the Consumer Reports group just put out some research not long ago showing that patients do, in fact, have concerns about whether their physicians receive these kinds of payments. Doctors say that it's a necessary part of the safe practice of medicine, that they can serve as experts to doctors in rural areas, for example, who might not have as many patients with certain conditions or who need certain kinds of drugs, and they can educate their peers.
And one aspect of the story is that some of that money is going to doctors working with the University of Louisville, which has a policy about this.
That's right. They do have a conflict of interest policy, and there's a medical student association that actually rates U of L's policy pretty well, saying that there's no direct ban on these sorts of relationships, but they are strongly discouraged, and they're employees of U of L aren't allowed to accept above fair market value, although there's no real strong definition of how they set that.
All right, and any thoughts that some more fallout might come from this?
It's only the largest companies that have started so far, and not all companies are reporting the same thing. For example, some are only reporting the larger amounts for the traveling and the speaking fees. Others, like Pfizer, you can go on there and find whether your doctor had a $10 lunch with someone. So as the deadline looms, there'll be much more information to come.
Certainly something to watch out for. Ed, we'll be turning back to you. HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, has been giving some money to the Housing Authority.
That's right. This was part of their kind of annual funding award to metro housing authorities nationwide. So the Louisville Housing Authority, they received $9.6 million was their allocation for the next fiscal year. That was a little less than what they got last year, about a 6% decline. But it actually was more than they thought they were going to get. They thought they might get hit pretty hard by some of the discussions of budget cuts in Washington.
And what can this money be used for?
Well, they get three phases of funding from the federal government. This is actually for capital improvements. They're going to use it for things like roof replacements, some boiler work to create better energy efficiency boilers at a couple of their facilities. And then there's a downtown facility that they acquired a few years ago. They're going to do a major renovation. It's called the Friary. And it's going to be used for public housing, but they're going to have about a $2.2 million project there.
All right. Well, thank you, both of you, for joining us. This is all the time we have. So thanks to Ed Green. Thanks to Steve Ivey of Business First.
Thanks, Gabe.
All right.
Thanks,
and
Gabe.
Also, thanks to Jesse Halliday from the Courier-Journal and from the WFPL newsroom, Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. And thank you to our callers. State of the News is produced by the WFPL newsroom. The production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information about the stories you heard, visit WFPL.org. You can also find out how to contact us there. Thanks for listening to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard.